Thank you for watching Conscious Consumer Network. The live stream broadcast is free to view. You can pause and rewind live broadcasts to catch up, or view shows at a later date by accessing our free archives of all shows. Check out our broadcast guide to see what's on. You can show your support by donating to our network support fund. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or subscribe to the monthly newsletter for updates. We thank you for supporting free and independent media.
Welcome, everyone, to the 53rd edition of Unspun. I'm Joe Atwell. I'm here with Jan Ervin and the fabulous Dr. Hans Utter, he of the impeccable intellect. Those of you who saw the last show that we did as an homage, or basically as a way of exposing the Summer of Love, this four-way conversation that Jan and I and Steve Outram had with Hans, will know just how interesting some of Hans's insights are. And tonight, if we're lucky, he's going to share even more with us. So welcome, Hans. Can you bring us up to speed with your most current insights into the counterculture, into culture in general?
Well, yeah, this is one of those things that struck me. I was actually talking to him. Allen Ginsberg is one of those people, okay, of course, he's very influential, but then the question is, why was he so influential? Who is he really, right? And I just had a very interesting experience in that there's sort of a decoding process, right? So I'd read Ginsberg. I was told these are great writers, you know, Burroughs and all this stuff. You know, I was a young beat wearing a beret and all that. And when I picked up Howl the other day, I was just shocked at how graphic but also how predictive he was for the counterculture. So I just thought it'd be interesting. I've got a recording of Margaret Mead, defining the Beat Generation, which is kind of interesting. So Margaret Mead was connected to the great anthropologist. But I just find it to be interesting. I thought maybe we could just kind of, go into a bit more detail about him and just kind of some of these interconnections. And I just want to, I'm almost like asking you guys too, like you can guide me. You can become my gurus, like Allen Ginsberg. But the question is, you look at the media coverage, right? You look at the extent that even this Beat Generation, which was actually about 6-7 people that maybe extended, very small, but became a major force or factor in American life. But at the same time, it was, it was obviously extensively promoted. And then when you look at Ginsberg's seminal role in constructing the entire counterculture. And what I find to be very interesting is that, like Steve read that newspaper story, right? So we got a front page newspaper story about a hippie doing an occult ritual, right? They're doing this occult ritual for the sun, to start off this generation, right? But this is written up in detail on the front page of a major newspaper when this stuff didn't even exist, right? So I just find it interesting. I just thought we could kind of delve into this a bit, and I'll, get in a bit more about Mr. Allen Ginsberg. So
sure. Yeah. Well, I'll throw in like a little tidbit. Going into MK Ultra, you have the idea of, well, who's giving LSD to who at the onset? Some people report that it was Gregory Bateson who dosed Allen Ginsberg, but that actually turns out to be incorrect. At least he didn't physically do it. The guy who gave support purportedly Ginsberg his first dose was a doctor who had been involved in mind control experiments for the government. Okay.
Is that Dr. Charles Savage by chance?
I think so, right. And so then the story goes, well, Bateson didn't know anything about that. That was just circumstantial that this mind control doctor with all of these connections to MKUltra just happened to be the one supposedly to give Ginsberg his first his first dose, and that sort of then launches Ginsberg into the whole hippie culture, because, you know, there is this transition, right? You start out with the beatniks, and Ginsberg is their gay man, young man. He's hanging around New York with Kerouac and some other guys. But then somehow, because it isn't just a completely natural transition, there he is at the BNs, and he's there, you know, in all of the MK Ultra stuff around San Francisco. So that's just a circumstance that is suspicious in light of the context of the influence on the counterculture that we can, you know, absolutely verify through Gordon Wasson and the MKUltra doctors. So Ginsberg, what really I'm trying to say is that it appears to me that the best way to understand Ginsberg is he is a lifetime actor. He's been someone who somehow at a very early age was brought into a kind of role that was part of the creation of the counterculture. And this goes all the way back to, you know, when he is just a little kid, basically. You know, I mean, that, they had the, that one child that we talked about on Saturday, that one program, which, you know, brought orphans in, tested them, and then, you know, somehow a lot of them would end up working in military intelligence. Well, Ginsberg is just kind of, in my mind, like that. I think that, you really want to look into his family and try to understand, well, how did this family get selected? And then the other thing that I just thought I'd throw out, I was going through all of the people, you know, and Ginsberg is one of them, who are involved in the creation of the counterculture from an administrative level. And I would include Ginsberg in that. And you know what I couldn't find, Hans and Jan? I couldn't find any blondes. Now, why is that? What happened to all the Scandinavian people? How come they didn't get to be an MKUltra? Every person I can find in what I would regard as some kind of administrative or, you know, a seminal point, even the rock and roll guys, they're all kind of, you know, dark haired. I'm just wondering, like, hey, that just strikes me as impossible, statistically.
What about Aldous Huxley or Tim Leary? Tim Leary was supposedly Irish, right?
Well, he's supposed to be Irish, but he wasn't a blonde, and Huxley is very dark, actually. If you look at pictures of him when he was a kid, pictures like I have one right here in the back of Brave New World when he's maybe, I don't know, it was shot in.
I guess so.
You know, he's very dark haired, and so. Just a little point of curiosity, you know how I am about these things. I just would like an explanation. But the thing that was just so powerful in the show that we just did was Outram's video of Ginsberg's addressing the NAMBLA organization. Because I have tried to get confirmation of his relationship to NAMBLA. Many people have alluded it. And I thought it would be very, very important because it would show people that this is a lifetime actor.
Let's just go to that clip here really quickly, Joe.
Sure. But anyway, finally we now have an absolute verification of pedophilia.
Are we ready?
Yep. Sure.
This is the poet Allen Ginsberg. Sweet boy, give me your ass. Let me kiss your face, lift your neck, touch your lips, tongue, tickle, tumbling, nose to nose, fat, belching, that was lovely, man, to the earth.
Unfortunately, the audio is highly distorted, but if we fast forward here, we can see that really is at NAMBLA. We can see the name up here on the banner. Man Boy Love Association thing going on here.
And also, if you listen closely to his words, you can see that he's actually engaged in a, you know, kind of a pornographic homage to pedophilia.
Well, his poetry became increasingly graphic. And let me just give a quote from Allen Ginsberg. He said, quote, "Attacks on NAMBLA stink of politics, witch hunting for profit, humorlessness, vanity, and ignorance. I'm a member of NAMBLA because I love boys too. Everybody does who has a little humanity." And he had an essay called Thoughts on NAMBLA in 1994. Quote, "NAMBLA's a forum for reform of those laws on youthful sexuality, which members deem oppressive. A discussion society, not a sex club. I joined NAMBLA in defense of free speech." Actually, the poem he read was called A Graphic Ode to Youth. So basically he's saying that I love boys. Can't we love boys and things like that. So he was quite a proponent of that. And the thing about Ginsberg is that, these guys were all kind of caught up in kinds of crime a little bit, connected with the underworld. You have Burroughs and Lucien Carr coming from very wealthy St. Louis family. That was a connection. I really know Burroughs, of course. I think his grandfather invented the Burroughs adding machine, so he never had to work a day in his life. But he, did lots of crazed activities. But Lucien Carr is a guy that introduced Ginsberg and sort of created the whole set. And Lucien Carr was an intelligent young man who had possibly been groomed by his phys ed teacher, a guy named Kramer. Lucien Carr actually murdered someone, and his defense was this guy was a homosexual trying to come on to him. But Lucien Carr had, of course, been involved in homosexuality for a long time. And he was, sort of a pretty boy or whatever. But that, so he was the link, and it'd be interesting to look at his family background because he had, again, you have these very wealthy families. And even though he was, very much involved in homosexual lifestyle, he murdered someone and said, this guy was trying to, was harassing me. And so he was in jail, ended up working for United Press, UPI. And Ginsberg was also running, he was selling stolen goods out of his dorm room at Columbia and ended up pleading insanity and spent some time in a mental hospital. But Ginsberg, basically, what I found very interesting as I looked over Howl is it really encodes the entire 1960s written in the early 50s, right? So
do you know, Hans, what hospital he was at?
Ah, that is a great question.
Yeah, it is.
It was in New York City, and I used was it Bellevue? I'm not sure off the top of my head. I used to know that, but he had his mother who was schizophrenic. He had his mother lobotomized, so he went ahead and had his mother turned into a vegetable, basically. And of course, he wrote this poem about her. But, Ginsberg is a very interesting character because you see this Beat Generation, they got, they started
Rockland, getting... Rockland State Hospital, go ahead.
Rockland State Hospital, okay, they might have to check that. But they got so much press, right? So this, you have the rock and roll stuff going on, right? But then the subtext is the Beats, right? Which becomes a precursor to the hippies. And in fact, is aimed at a higher level demographic, right? More college educated, a little bit more intellectual, obviously, than the than your average, rock fan or something like that. But I think that the fundamental thing to realize is that this movement, it's a human being that started the Summer of Love, and as evidenced by the footage we looked at from that earlier festival with the band Demon Lover playing, right?
Right.
Okay, that looked very staged to me, right? I'm looking at the timing of people walking by, these men with their shirt off, crisscrossing. You have a couple dancing. Everything looks kind of staged. And then you've got, a Stuart Brand wearing his white jumpsuit talking about walking around like a dog on all fours to expand the mind. So you have all these players, but there's no hippies there, right? There's no hippies. Even the hippie dance they're doing is very much proto. And so... with even, in conjunction in the Haight-Ashbury district, Ginsberg was instrumental, right, as they set up this community. And in fact, when he was put in jail, he lamented that this whole movement would just die, right? But the movement itself, you've got the music, but primarily you have this whole overlay a philosophical overlay, an entire lifestyle, an entire fully constructed lifestyle that just suddenly pops out in 1967. Now you have, obviously, there's rollouts. Obviously, we talked extensively about the freeform radio. But as I mentioned, suddenly you have a massive amount of airtime available. On January 1st, 1967, you've got The Human Being, then you have The Summer of Love, and then you have all the psychedelic rock being rolled out nationwide on the FM radio, right? You have all these bands getting massive national attention, you know, as a precursor to The Summer of Love. Of course, you have the San Francisco song. But, you know, as and as we talked about before, you have artists like, you know, Steve Miller, who is basically just getting started, opening up for Miles Davis. You have all the, you know, Otis Redding. You have all these major top billing R&B, blues, jazz artists that are Dizzy Gillespie. You know, this guy was a living legend, right? He was major, you know, one of the most important jazz trumpet players of all time. And, you know, deservedly so, recognized as a stellar musician. And he's opening up for some of these hippie psychedelic bands at The Human Being. So that, you know, shows that the entire cultural edifice wasn't something that developed organically, right? It sort of just plopped down in the culture. It was dropped on the culture. You have The Human Being with, you know, national, international media coverage, right? That, and so this is what makes it quite interesting, right? And then, you know, again, I'll do that a bit later, but I wanted to, you know, just looking at how and what it's espousing. And then again, the fact that this guy was considered the greatest living American poet, you know, nominated for so many awards. There's an Allen Ginsberg Poetry Prize. You know, he became recognized as basically considered to be the greatest poet. He was translated into more languages than any other poet by 1968. So this guy, you know, and if you look at his poetry, I mean, you know, if the thing is that
it's rubbish.
what shocked me is that some of these books that I'd read, the other stuff, it was almost like my mind shut off and I wasn't capturing what he was actually talking about. You know, like for example, William S. Burroughs, I started reading this Nova Express book again because he has some interesting stuff about the 60s rock and counterculture that he revised this trilogy of books, Nova Express, Ticket That Exploded, Soft Machine. But Nova Express, it starts out, you know, just describing graphic, you know, homosexual activity, orgies, you know, talks about this. He mentions this boy who would go into convulsions and have orgasms one after another. And the boy said, well, I have a magic man that will put your spirit in my body so you can experience what I'm experiencing. But really just graphic, you know, heroin. And, you know, in the first 10 pages of that, it's very hardcore. And I'm thinking, wow, I find this hardcore now. And this was published in 55, you know, and then you look at his later books, they're being published by major, not just, you know, City Lights books and these kind of underground, but they're being published by the top literary publishers in the world internationally, right? So you have these guys really being elevated and create this pantheon, right? And so I'll let you chime in there and then I'll just read some lines from this.
Well, you know, I had the misfortune of reading a bunch of Howl last spring in New York while I was there doing research on the Woodstock thing. And, you know, it's disgusting like all the rest of it. Thankfully, I've already blocked some of it out. But, you know, what I wanted to mention, this at the start of the show, but we actually got dinged by YouTube for playing a couple of those clips on the live presentation on Saturday, and they pulled the whole presentation off of the YouTube website with, you know, it was already, you know, in 24 hours it had 3,000 views or more. But, you know, people can still access it from the Gnostic Media website, but they did pull that. We're having to censor a number of Ginsberg and Leary clips out, ironically, from The Human Being, which was all supposed to be anti-government and anti-establishment and this stuff. And meanwhile, you know, even discussing a 50-year anniversary, this organization, I forget, Music something or other, had the entire video taken down.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to, you know, and that's, I mean, you know, I'm not going to state, there's a whole bunch of connections that I want to pull out here, but it's not just disgusting. It is a model for the counterculture. It is a model of the lifestyle, of the belief systems, and the romance, right? So let me just read a couple lines. I can't do it like him because he goes, I saw the best minds of my generation drive. Okay, it doesn't sound very good. But so the first line, I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked. And this is a line usually they're going to quote on television. They're not going to get deeper into the poem. But the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness. So the whole thing is that they're living in this oppressive system, the McCarthy era, the war, all this stuff. And so it's become hopeless, right? You have this, and they describe, you know, as a reaction against McCarthyism, the war machinery. And so it's very much connected with communism, right? I mean, Ginsburg was a lifelong communist and, in fact, promoted communism extensively. But the next line, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix. Angel-headed hipsters burning for ancient heavenly connections to the starry dynamos in the machinery of night. So we've got, first of all, we've already set up now, we've got this generate, they're being destroyed by society. They're starving, hysterical, naked, and they're going to score heroin and score drugs, you know, in the, basically in the, you know, black part of town connected with the criminal underworld, especially through Burroughs. But then you have angel-headed hipsters, right? So they're dreaming for this transcendent philosophy. So not only have they been driven mad, but they're going out to score heroin, and then they're like these sort of, you know, they're becoming like this supernatural spiritual quest, and it's this redemption of society. And that's a very important theme, is even when they're just unknown guys, you know, a group of friends hanging out and doing what they're doing, it's being written as they are offering the solution. They're not only creating the problem, that their minds are destroyed, you know, by McCarthyism, by the conservative 1950s society, right? And it goes on, you know, they bared their souls to heaven under the L, you know, and then mostly, you know, people stop their reading there. You know, but then we get a little bit, you know, who got busted in their pubic beards returning through Laredo with a belt of marijuana for New York, who ate fire in paint hotels or drank turpentine in Paradise Alley, death or purgatory their torsos at night with dreams, with drugs, with endless nightmares, alcohol and cock and endless balls. So, you know, and he's describing, you know, carried in unshaven rooms, burning their money in waste baskets, listening to the tear through the wall. So you have this horror, right? It is the visceral horror of the 1950s American society that's causing this breakdown, that's creating this generation, right? So they're not necessarily doing it by choice. They're being impelled. Okay, so he's smuggling marijuana in their pubic beards. I'm not sure what it means, eight fire and paint hotels, purgatory their torsos, which seems like, you know, what, male prostitution, whatever, this, and then, you know, endless cock and balls. So you're jumping, it has this, again, this movement from the terror to the result, and then their sort of transcendence, right, through this debauchery or sexuality. And right here, next line I'll read is, peyote solidities of halls, backyard green tree cemetery dawns, wine drunkenness over the rooftops, joyful tea ride, neon blinking lights, sun and moon, tree vibrations in the roaring dusk of Brooklyn, ash cans ranting in kind king light of mind. So peyote, right? So you already have this introduction of hallucinogens already in hell, right? So the hallucinogens are being introduced. And then, you know, it's always connected with this intoxication. T-Ride is, you know, cannabis, right? So they're consuming cannabis, they're getting drunk, but they're also gaining this, you know, spiritual transcendence. I'll just read a little bit more. You know, a lost battalion of platonic conversationalists jumping down the stoops off fire escapes, off windowsills, off Empire State, out of the moon. So there's a suicide, right? The platonic conversationalists are jumping out of windows. They're ending their lives. They're committing suicide. You know, whole whole intellects disgorged in total recall for 7 days and nights with brilliant eyes, meet for the synagogue, cast out on the pavement. You know, so it's, I mean, there's a lot here in that, okay, Benzedrine, you know, up for 72 hours of taking Benzedrine, and then, you know, so these drug binges for days or weeks at a time, creating this transcendental state, which again is impelled by the evil of America. Basically, it's America. It's the evil of this country. And they're so disenfranchised, even though they're all Columbia students, right? And so, you know, and as I look at this, it's almost, it has this thing, if you read this as good literature, put your judgment down. It's starting to program your mind also, right? In a subconscious way. There's all kinds of things in here that, while they seem poetic, looking at this text, it is very much a model, you know, for this entire movement.
A blueprint.
It's deliberate programming. I mean, in other words, it isn't poetry. It's well constructed neurolinguistic programming to get people to start losing their normal consciousness and start shifting over into madness or whatever it is they have in mind.
Now, a real question here is, aside from this sick pedophile promoting himself and being a part of this, who elevated him to America's greatest poet? Who put this out there to not only corrupt other poets, but to corrupt, you know, anybody who read this stuff as America's quote-unquote best poetry?
Sure. Which is, it had been completely organized, right?
Absolutely. I mean, look, but the question is who, and you know, well, where's the trail to that?
This is always the question.
And one thing I'll note here, like, so most of this, there's these stanzas, there's no punctuation at all, right? So every word just running together. So just read a little bit more. Who lit cigarettes in boxcars, racketing through snow towards lonesome farms in Grandfather Night. Who studied Plotinus, Poe, St. John of the Cross, telepathy, and Bob Kabbalah, because the cosmos instinctively vibrated it at their feet in Kansas. Who loaned it through the streets of Idaho seeking visionary Indian angels. Who were visionary Indian angels? The hell does that mean? Seeking visionary Indian angels.
Doesn't that sound like Jim Morrison, you know, when he's talking about going across the desert?
Yeah, I mean, but this is exactly. Yeah. Who were? You have this double movement who thought they were mad only when Baltimore gleaned in supernatural ecstasy. But we go, who lit cigarettes in boxcars, racketing through snow towards lonesome farms and Grandfather Night. So these boxcars, okay, were they really hobos? I don't think so, but notice this rhythm, boxcars, which actually, you know, it's kind of cool. It sounds like a train. But the farms, this is a traditional America that they want to destroy, that is destroying them, right? That is making them starving, hysterical, naked, right? So you're setting this idea of this fundamental disillusion. It's not something that's coming from interacting specifically with the society, but, you know, it's the entire edifice of culture, the farms, the traditional values, but they're, you know, Plotinus, again, punctuation, so it just runs in your mind as this hypnotic thing. You know, Poe, St. John of the Cross, telepathy, and Bob Kabbalah. So, you know, they're connecting with this literary spiritual hodgepodge, right? You have the Indian element, you have this sort of readers you're supposed to read as a hippie, right? There's a whole literature. When someone was a hippie, they'd start reading these books, right? There was an intellectual conversion. And that conversion is already, you know, 15 years before, is already coming out, you know, with the blueprint, you know, going to Mexico. And who burned cigarette holes in their arms protesting the narcotic tobacco haze of capitalism, who distributed super communist pamphlets in Union Square, weeping and undressing while the sirens of Los Alamos wailed them down and wailed down Wall and Staten Island Ferry also wailed. So you know, it their own wild cooking pederasty and intoxication. So he's talking about having sex with detectives. He's talking about, okay, so they're burning holes in his arm because it's so bad living in this capitalist society. And then there, you know, then of course Los Alamos. So Los Alamos is linked with this nuclear fear, right? They're connecting with this fear of the bomb, the primal fear of the Cold War, right? The primal fear, but the solution is becoming a communist who bit detectives in the neck and shrieked with delight in police cars for committing no crime but their own wild cooking pederasty and intoxication, who howled on their knees in the subway and were dragged off the roof, waving genitals and manuscripts, who let themselves be fucked in the ass by saintly motorcyclists and screamed with joy, who blew and were blown by those human seraphim, the sailors, caresses of Atlantic and Caribbean love. So there's talking about pedophilia, the seraphim, right? He's going overseas right. to engage in pederasty. But also, I mean, you know, if this is now about sex, scattering their semen freely, whoever may come by. So he's just waving, basically waving his genitalia, having sex with everybody, everything that moves, you know, being arrested, but then he's doing this for freedom of speech. You know, who lost their love boys to the three-year-old shrews of fate, and the one-eyed shrew, the heterosexual dollar. And the one-eyed shrew, you know, and it goes on and on, who copulated ecstatic and insatiate with a bottle of beer and a sweetheart, a package of cigarettes, candles, fell off the bed, continued on the floor, ended up fainting on the wall with visions of ultimate cunt come eluding the last jism of consciousness. So, flashing buttocks under barns and naked by the lake. Okay, so, look, I mean, we're going, if you're reading this, and this guy's a great poet, and you're reading it with that frame that this is great literature. Right. I'm not smart enough to understand it. Walt Whitman was a phenomenal poet. Possibly Walt Whitman was homosexual, but maybe not. Maybe he was. Fine. But he, you know, you have someone like Michelangelo being considered homosexual by Freud because of a mistranslation of Michelangelo's dream, right? Michael, you know, to embrace the human body or the male form does not mean you're homosexual. So you're going from that point to just this endless graphic pedophilic sex, Turkish bath, blonde and naked angel came to pierce them with a sword. You know, three-year-olds, seraphim. I mean, I don't know how else you want to say that he's out there having sex with boys, but then he's having this thing, the last jism of consciousness is like this ultimate transcendence, right? So you set up this constant rhythm between, again, the oppressive society, the actions that are done, which are intoxication, which are taking drugs or having sex. And then from these, you get this payoff of this transcendence, which is actually being promoted as the liberation for the entire society. So it has this ethos of full cultural liberation. But, you know, just one, I won't torment you guys too much more with this, but went out whoring through Colorado in myriad stolen cars. NC, this is Neil Cassady. So NC is Neil Cassady, secret hero of these poems, cocksmith and Adonis of Denver. Joy, and then he goes on and on, basically talking about all the different places that he slept with all these different women driving across the country as a cocksmith. I mean, I can read it, his innumerable lays of girls and empty lots, dinner backyards, blah, blah, blah. But already, so Neil Cassady is brought in, and Neil Cassady again became the guru for the entire basis of the entire hippie family system, right? We did that in Laying the Dead the Rest. So Neil Cassady already in the early 50s is being set up as this transcendental figure for this new America, for this counterculture, which is actually a movement to destroy or reinvert, to subvert the entire culture, but coming from a very different angle, right? At the same time, there's a note of this superiority, that we are in possession of the holy wisdom, right? We are the people that will offer this to the generations. But so we've already have peyote mentioned. We already have, you know, this constant thing of suicide and then more transcendence, you know, and then, you know, cut their wrists three times successively, gave up and opened up antique stores where they thought they were growing old and cried. Well, the antique store is a reference to him moving stolen property through his dorm room, right? Where he pled insanity not to go to jail. So you have this constant movement of the suicide with these ecstatic stuff, dying, being reborn, salvation, you know, insulin, metacultural, electricity, hydrotherapy, psychotherapy, occupational therapy, catatonia, etc. So all these different things of madness with mother finally, there's five stars. With mother finally, I would assume it's F-U-C-K-E-D. And because he talks about in this, his poem, Cadeth, about his mother lying naked on the bed and how he wants, you know, she's been lobotomized and he wants to have sex with his old, you know, fat mother. So he brings that up with mother finally, what do those five stars stand for? And the last fantastic book was thrown out of the window, right? And so, you know, archangels and souls and, you know, pater omnipotens eternal Dios. So they're becoming connected with the eternal God, you know, suffering of America's naked mind. In a sense, they are set up already as these Christ-like figures who are redeeming the entire nation. And in fact, this is said explicitly in many ways, you know, over and over again. And so, you know, in this, you have the entire model of the 60s counterculture, right? They're rebelling against the war. They're rebelling through drugs, sex, intoxication, suicide, madness, death, etc. And I'll finish up here with, I don't want to read too much more of this stuff, of this quote-unquote poetry. But then he has this thing about Moloch, which supposedly he is, every word has an explanation point after, right? You know, what sphinx of cement and aluminum bashed open their skulls and ate up the brains and imagination. So this sphinx, this is society, you know, capitalist Western society, you know, Moloch, solitude, filth, ugliness, children screaming, boys sobbing in armies, old men, Moloch, nightmares of Moloch, the heavy judge over men, Moloch, you know, Moloch, Congress, okay, he's going on, Moloch, whose mind is pure machinery, Moloch, whose breast is a cannibal dynamo, Moloch, whose ear is a smoking tomb, Moloch, whose skyscrapers stand in the long streets like endless Jehovah's. So, you know, then you start thinking, is he criticizing Moloch? Moloch, whose name is the mind, you know?
Doesn't sound like it to me. It sounds like it's an homage to Moloch.
Well, let me interject something here, Hans.
Yeah.
And I've read this quote before. This is out of Jay Stevens' book, Storming Heaven. And he says, from there, meaning Jack Kerouac, Gary Snyder, and Allen Ginsberg's days with Burroughs, they knew that one of the quickest ways to disrupt the rational mind was with drugs, but not all drugs. Marijuana worked fairly well, but an even better disruptor was peyote and its synthetic cousin, mescaline. LSD didn't enter the beat scene until the end of the 50s, but when it did, it quickly became the tool of choice for achieving that ancient heavenly connection. Ginsberg took some peyote in the fall of 1955. Looking out his window, he, meaning Ginsberg, had a vision of Moloch, the biblical idol whose worship was distinguished by the burning of children. Moloch was America, Ginsberg flashed, and he began writing a poem about this intuition.
Yeah, and he says, you know, Moloch is cock, Moloch is balls, Moloch is this, and then the next part he says, holy, my asshole is holy, my cock is holy, I'm sorry to say all this bad language, but this is,
yeah, this is probably an R-rated show here for discussing this,
and this guy's a, you know, literary figure.
Yeah,
and then the writing is crappy. Let me go ahead and play this Margaret Mead clip talking about the beach real quick. We're running out of time.
Yeah, no,
hopefully it won't be too long so we don't get dinged for it.
It's only 2 minutes, so here we go. This is Margaret Mead defining the beat generation.
A beatnik. Hello, Eileen.
Thank you, Todd. When we met a couple of weeks ago, you asked me some questions about the beat generation. and I'm going to try to provide some answers for this new term, which you and our listeners find in our vocabulary. A fountainhead of knowledge in this regard is Allen Ginsberg, a Beat Generations poet, whose poetic endeavors have been put together in a book which he calls Howl, H-O-W-L. To dissect the whys and wherefores of the Beat Generation, we have Dr. Margaret Mead, the world-famous sociologist and anthropologist, whose newest book, People and Places, came out just yesterday. Dr. Mead, just in passing, and it's quite a passing we're doing, is adjunct professor of anthropology at Columbia and associate curator of ethnology at the Museum of Natural History.
As wow.
To start our discussion under a full head of steam, I just want to ask a brief question to which I would appreciate it if you both would give me a brief answer. For the benefit of our audience, who have sometimes read the word, sometimes known something about it, but not all about it, Dr. Mead, would you be kind enough to tell me what is the definition of a beatnik?
It's a name that's used at present for a group of young people who are interested in the arts, not interested in the kind of society we have, travel around the world a great deal with a good lot of addresses, and the men usually wear beards.
All right, you as a man with a beard, Mr. Ginsberg, what is your answer? What is your definition of the Beat Generation?
My beard is new.
Well, maybe you're a new beatnik.
I have no definition except that it seems a word of insult usually applied to people interested in the arts at this point.
All right. Now, you said that you considered it a word of insult, Mr. Ginsberg, but on the other hand, it is a word that has been a headline in magazine articles in some of our best magazines, and certainly in our newspapers, and it seems to typify a generation that is not typified in any other way or under any other heading. Why is it an insult?
Remember that our best magazine and newspapers are quite corrupt in the sense that they are willing to pander to any kind of vulgar taste to make a sort of sadistic angle on a story if they can find one. This is sort of like a first principle in any modern journalism.
Isn't it also thought that the magazines would say that the beatnik or the beat generation is a vulgarity in itself?
Well, that's the very principle from which they started, for the most part.
Are you prepared to defend that position?
Their position?
Yeah. No, your position.
Well, no, I don't feel like defending myself.
All right, Dr. Mead. Now, you explained what you thought it was. Do you want to explore that a little farther for us?
Well, I agree with Mr. Ginsberg to the extent that we do, in the mass media today, tend to coin phrases very rapidly. They became.
Oh, sorry, that's a longer clip. But, I mean, I think that's just interesting that Margaret Mead, there's a longer interview about that, but she was at Columbia also. And, you know, I started to think that the real application, you know, of this stuff actually being applied, you just go back to Boas, right? This cultural relativism. Right. Then you've got Margaret Mead, the great, I'm sure you've covered her, right, with her little fraud that she did, anthropological fraud.
But, oh, well, Margaret, well, you know, not to mention Margaret Mead was, of course, married to Gregory Bateson, who helped co-found the CIA. And, you know, Gordon Wasson, Henry A. Murray, Tim Leary, Carl Rogers, you know, we got a John Dewey. We got a ton of these agents that we've exposed that were all out of Columbia there.
Yeah, and so you have Ginsberg, his interest in the arts, but I mean, again, that poem, you know, it, if you read it in the frame that this guy is a great artist or great poet, I think a lot of the words are going to be subconsciously registered because it doesn't really make any sense, right? You're not going to, you know, because I didn't remember a lot of those lines, right? You know, I finally blanked my mother, you know, da da da, 4 a.m., you know, but it's just, I mean, seraphim, 3-year-olds, you know, little piercing little angels with a sword, you know, I mean, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, this is the media attention, even if it was quote unquote negative, these guys were on, you know, Jack Harrop was on the Steve Allen show. These guys were getting international media attention, as the lady said, from the highest level of the media. They got massive media push. You have that Maynard G. Krebs character, you know, showing up in there's a sitcom. The guy became Gilligan.
Dobie Gillis.
Yeah, Dobie Gillis. Right. And so, you know, you had just had this thing pushed, you know, I mean, you start, you know, actually pull, there was so much push even, you know, for even, you know, novelty items and this and this and this. And then you have, oh, this is bad. You shouldn't do it. You shouldn't do it. Of course, that's telling people to do it, right? This is drawing people in, and it's hyped and pumped up. And then suddenly you have him showing up, as he said, Neil Cassidy told him. Neil Cassidy convinced him to move to San Francisco. Neil Cassidy going to San Francisco. And then Ginsburg is arranging and setting up the philosophical basis for the entire counterculture and summoning Maitreya Buddha, who's connected with this, you know, the New Age cult and all that stuff. And so you can almost see this, you know, the ritualistic aspect of it, which is being televised to the nation, televised to the world. So it's really inducting this ritual, not only on those people who are participating, but on everyone that's watching it, however they're reacting to it, right? So, I mean, you know, there's, of course, a lot more to be done, but I look at this poem. That, why was it made so important? Oh, it got this obscenity trial. And I think it even went up to the Supreme Court or something, right? So this is obscene or not, and it's a great poem. But, you know, as what I read, I think that I would call that pretty obscene, even by today's standards. And you go back to the mid-50s, you know, it's I would call it pretty extreme. I mean, not saying that it shouldn't have been published, but, you know, I'm saying that, you know, it is so obscene that, especially when you understand the, you know, some of the encoded language in there, it's just really over the top. And is this literature? But then everyone's going to have to read it because of the trial, right? And you're setting up, like I said, not just
right. So let me just interject something. I mean, bear in mind that this whole thing is orchestrated, okay? And it's not, and you have all these moving parts, because at the same time, Albert Kinsey is bringing out his bogus science. Alfred Kinsey is bringing out his bogus science, and he has a whole department of the federal law enforcement that is promoting his work in terms of all the state legislatures, so that local governments couldn't create obscenity laws to restrict this kind of stuff. Because you see, in the 20s, the teens, the local sovereigns would have been able to have just said, well, this is obscene, and these books cannot be brought in across the county line, right? But this is all changing now. The legal structure that permits the pornography to be inserted is working hand in hand with the promotion of Ginsburg's filth. And I would then just point out that the staccatic talking that the verses, you know, where he's not really giving full sentences, and it's sort of hard to follow.
That's NLP, isn't it?
Exactly. That this whole thing is designed. I mean, the way that this beat poetry has been created was designed to get past the conscious mind and to code people basically for pornographic lifestyles. You know, I mean, people may think that this is far-fetched, but I don't think so. I think that that the sum total of these coincidences and weird events has the best interpretive framework, has the clearest, most easy to understand, it makes the most sense in just saying, you know, this was all one organized op. And that the culture we have now with the 24/7 pornography was set in motion by these guys because they knew that in that world, families couldn't exist, right? And they wanted to atomize. Everything was about atomizing the society from to make it deracinated, to make it without any ethnic community, to make all of the old, the little and well-established Catholic communities, you know, like Latvians and Polish and things. I mean, all of these things were under attack, and the goal was to create the sole individual in the middle class, right? That had you know, no real social support around him, because that individual would be trivial to control.
Yeah, and that was an excellent point that you brought up, because this connection with Kinsey is in fact, the term the Beat Generation was coincided 1948, right? Coinciding with the Kinsey report. And in fact, how is, you have that level, the cultural level, of course you have Kinsey, you know, cover of Time magazine, and obviously the promotion of pedophilia, which is going, I mean, we're in a massive thing, you know, child sexuality and all this stuff is just being rammed down our throats. But this is actually coincides with it. And if you look at it as a movement, because you see, you have the Beat generation was promoted all over the place. I mean, it became something you could kind of play with. It was cool. It was hip. It was in a movie in 1949, the Beats were showing up in films. So the question is, how did these guys that, you know, so there's a movie called DOA, right? And these guys are, you know, so it's the beginning of the, you know, again, the Beat generation, 1953, Roman Holiday has the Beats in it. So it's showing up in Hollywood. It takes a couple of years to get films into production. Or maybe they did this stuff super quick, but if Kerouac came up with a term in 1948, and these guys supposedly were just unknown driving across the country, you know, taking speed and whatever, and all their drugs they were doing. But it's showing up in so many ways. There was a Beat musical, the Nervous Set, that was put on, you know, so it became a massive cultural movement, even for kids. You know, you have kids, you know, into it, lots, you know, films. It was massively promoted as this dangerous, you know, type of thing, you know, and there's a couple quotes, you know, the authentic Beat attitude is, you know, this is from, well, whatever, much of Beat culture represented a negative stance more than a positive one. It was motivated by a feeling of cultural and emotional displacement, dissatisfaction, and yearning than by a specific program. It was many conflicting, shifting states of mind. And so this idea that the Beats themselves, it's based on this idea of being fractured. Your mind is fractured. You're fractured. You're insane because the world is insane. Because Moolah is oppressing you. And then there's just another quote about this, about Beat Generation from another scholar. Beat Generation sold books, sold black turtleneck sweaters and bongos, berets and dark glasses, sold a way of life that seemed like dangerous fun, thus to be either condemned or imitated. Suburban couples could have beatnik parties on Saturday night and drink too much and fondle each other's wives. So you have it moving, you know, is something to play with in the, you know, the upscale. You have it, you know, showing up on TV. You have kids imitating it. You have it in movies. But behind that image of the hipster, hey, daddy-o, that's real cool, baby. Oh, swing it. Behind it, you have the seminal literature is Howl, which is, you know, which I think is a programming exercise in a certain way. If you get tens of thousands of millions of people to read this that are not going to understand it, especially if they don't read poetry, it's going to really serve as it's like an Ericksonian hypnosis type of a text that's impregnating your mind with certain images are going to be clear, and then your mind's going to go blank as you read on, and that's where these images are going to be populated in your mind. And exactly, the connection with Kinsey and all these other things are happening simultaneously. At the same time, you have rock and roll, right? So the Beats were on a high culture level phenomena, and rock and roll is on a low culture level.
Let me bring something up here from the database, because I've actually been mapping out something that coincides with what you're saying here. So originally, we had the Bohemians, and the Bohemians tied to the Bohemian Club. We have Arthur Klepps with the Boohoo Cults. The Boohoo is the Bohemians. The Bohemians, there's the first and then the second generation, and then that kind of branches over into this Lost Generation, which is Mind Op version one. I have it mapped. And then we go into the Beat Generation, which is Mind Op version two. And then the hippie movement, Mind Op version 3, rock music, Mind Op version 4, and now moving into the transhumanist agenda.
Yeah. And in fact, I was going to play a clip of Allen Ginsberg talking about the human species mutating and becoming this one mind, you know, this mutation of the human species. Like,
I'd love to hear that. Do you have that available, Hans?
I have it queued up. Let me go ahead and...
thank you. I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, hopefully I have it at the right spot. Here we go.
Silver teeth flashing up their shit-mouth grin, weeping in their martinis. There is no secret to the success of the 6 billionaires that own all time since the Gnostic revolt in Egypto. They built the Sphinx to confuse my sex life. Well, fuck the void. Why are they starting that war all over again in Laos over neutral mind? Is the United States CIA Army overthrowing somebody like Angelica Balabanoff again? 6,000 movie theaters, 100 million television sets, 1 billion radios, wires and wireless crisscrossing the hemispheres, semaphore lights and Morse, all telephones ringing at once to connect every mind by its ears to one vast consciousness. This time apocalypse, everybody waiting for one mind to break through. Man, prophet with two eyes, dare all creation with his dying tongue and say, I am. Messiah swallowed back his death into his stomach, gazed through the great pupils of his body's eyes, and look in each eye, man, that eyeglass, fearful, period look. That might be God's eye, see through.
Sorry, it's about 15 minutes. I may have queued it up, but you got some of that. Basically, he talks, you know, joined to this one mind, and he said human beings were mutating, radical mutation, you know. And so I'll have to edit that clip out for you. That's from the Esalon Institute Poetry of Madness Forum, which he began. Oh, great. The poetry of madness, and he begins his talk with to summon the Maitreya Buddha. He starts out chanting, and he also showed up the firing line with William Buckley in 1968, and he's on this show, and he starts playing his harmonium and singing and all this stuff. But it's very interesting that you can almost see William Buckley, this icon of conservatism, playing with Ginsberg. They're both acting parts of the polarities, right?
Well, remember, Buckley is just, you know, he's skull and bones, for God's sakes. I mean, he's wired absolutely into the whole oligarch structure. And he's not blonde. So, you know, who is Buckley? All I can say is that we can know him by his action. And he also plays with Gore Vidal in the same way. That kind of promotes or makes normalized homosexual behavior, because Vidal was really the very first outed homosexual to get in, you know, so much media attention. So, you know, they've got both sides of the dialectic under control, you know, but they're both in operation to whole population. Yeah,
it's just like the dialectic between Timothy Leary and G. Gordon Liddy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's just how it works. And so, you know, the public needs to be aware of this, that just because someone, you know, is a conservative doesn't mean that he's not part of the mind control, you know, population. It's just that he's working that side of the street. This has really been valuable, Hans. Thanks so much for sharing it. Really important, because you can place Ginsberg so clearly now as a political operative, and people can see that the poetry is just weaponized anthropology. It's not sincere. I mean, it's a kind of sophistry that presents itself as a poem, but then underneath it you have the beginning of to move people toward pornography, to pedophilia, and basically to psychosis, because even the way that the sentences are set up, you know, it just drives people nuts.
Yeah, and there's embedded, well, I mentioned, you know, like slashing his wrist 3 times, you know, electroshock. Yeah. In between this pornography, and then there's these moments of quote-unquote illumination where he's basically setting himself up as a messiah, right? They are, and the dialectic, I was just reading The Republic the other day, you know, Plato talks about the dialect as this social process that will, as Hegel does, that will evolve the entire culture to this, you know, state. And that's what he's talking about. He said, we're all one mind, you know, and the people with the martini glasses, that's the, you know, ruling elite there. And you know what I mean? So we can, you know, go more and more, but
we've only got 1 minute left here, less than a minute.
But Hans, really fascinating stuff. And thank you for bringing this to the public. It just couldn't be more valuable.
You know, and I've been wanting to cover the Bohemians, and I think this will tie right into it nicely. Sorry, go ahead, Joe.
No, I just wanted to thank Hans and to, support Hans, for heaven's sake. So Hans, tell people how to get to you and how to be able to support your work.
Quickly.
Yeah. HansUtter.com, and I got CDs, donations. I have a blog, mindcontrolmusic.wordpress.com. And or is it Music Mind Control? Something like that.
How do they get a hold of you?
Gnosticmedia.com. Gnosticmedia.com. Please support the show and all we do here. And Joe, how do they get a hold of you?
CaesarsMessiah.com. The donate button is right there. And don't forget the network, CCN. It helps, get all this information out to everyone. Real valuable stuff.
Yeah, and thanks, guys, for having me on the show again. It was a great pleasure.
Oh, man, it's our pleasure. Thank you, Hans.
Take care, Hans. Take care, Joe. Good night. Yeah, take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If we want to change the world, we must first change the media. Mainstream media exists for the purposes of indoctrination and manipulation of public perception. The world of free and independent media is growing, and with the upsurge in information now available in the public domain, it has never been easier to access free and independent media. The exploration of this information resulted in an experimental project which would provide a fully supported space for researchers, whistleblowers, and seekers of all kinds to express themselves and educate the world. On the 1st of January 2015, Conscious Consumer Network was launched to the world. Nobody thought we would make it this far, but CCN is the longest running free and independent media network of its kind. CCN is a unique collaboration of hearts and souls, bringing you information from different perspectives to educate and inform. Since we started CCN, we have had only one desire, the pursuit of a free, fair, just, sustainable world. And this has not changed. Having overcome many challenges over the last 2 years, CCN is here to stay, and we've got great things lined up for 2017. Help keep CCN on the air by supporting the 2017 Network Support Fund.